Okay, thank you, Tony. Everybody hear that? Yeah, that's good. Well, first, thank you for a very, very nice invitation. And Tony asked if I would come down and talk about global warming, and that's not really my field. I've moved into the question of what to do about global warming, and that puts me in a very radical position. So you're going to hear a strange talk today, which I'll show you some very new results and some different ways of looking at the problem. It's certainly not free from controversy, but it's awfully interesting, and you'll see some very strange effects at work. I'll show a bunch of view graphs and then some rather nice videotapes. So don't get too bored with the view graphs. The videotapes are kind of cool. And again, Tony asked if I would give the first part of the talk on the global warming problem, the background, and then the second part on what to do about it, and I'll try and follow through on that. And that this nice slide illustrates the question. That's actually the cover of the American Chemical Society journal, Environmental Science and Technology, of a couple of years ago. And the big question mark is on the matter of what should we do about carbon dioxide emissions? What should we put CO2 in the ocean? And they had a whole issue on that. And I was very struck by the fact that though there was a lot of talk, there wasn't much data. And in a small way, my colleagues and I decided to do something about that. And with a couple of people and $500 worth of equipment and a day at sea, we began a set of experiments which have really kind of thrived and led us to where we are now. And I'd like to give you some of the history of this. And here's one of my very, very favorite people, the late Roger Revelle. And it's a good starting point for this discussion, because in the years after World War II, when Roger was at Scripps, he wrote this a very famous paper in 1957 about human beings carrying out a large-scale geophysical experiment. And that's the putting CO2 in the atmosphere and causing global warming. And for 40 years since then, our scientific community has rallied around the great geophysical experiment phrase. The problem is that all experiments are supposed to have a result. You just can't keep it doing the same thing over and over again. And at the risk of making some of my colleagues mad, I'd like to suggest we do have a result today. And it's the end of the experiment. There should be an end. And if you look in the fine print of Roger's paper and go beyond the great geophysical experiment, he had some bets on this. In the coming decades, we'll increase CO2 between 20% and 40%. This should be adequate to determine whether climate's changing. The pre-industrial level is about 280 parts per million carbon dioxide. Right now, it's about 365. That's a 30% increase. Roger said 20 to 40, so let's give him 30%, plus or minus 10. And we'll see how he did. And almost to the day that the atmospheric CO2 levels reached the 30% increase, we got these very big international committees announcing to the world that climate's change. And of course, it should have been no surprise. It was predicted 40 years ago. It was done very simply. And it's embarrassing or engaging to report that if you go back to early in the century and you look at the predictions of the delta T from a doubling of greenhouse gases, they're almost identical to the numerical value today. It's just that we've learned to do the calculation so much better with so many sophisticated models, including so many variables, but the number has stayed the same. So climate has changed. It's in all the newspapers. It's in, is everything okay, Tony?
Sorry?
Everything okay? You're looking, am I,
is no, no, that I was wondering if some of the people on that side, maybe perhaps you could, you want to move to the other side where we're standing?
Come on over.
Yeah, feel free to.
What we've had for 30-odd years are diagrams like this. And I've seen these countless times. There's little cartoons of the factory chimneys and the forests and the ocean and the atmosphere, and how many billion tons there are of carbon there are in each one, and the carbon goes around. And the fossil fuel use, like in this view graph, is 5 billion tons a year of carbon. It's up around 7 now. This view graph's out of date. The atmosphere has a carbon dioxide reservoir. It's growing. The ocean circulates a lot of CO2, and it gets some extra. They've got an additional 3 going in there. The IPCC reports back in estimated 2 billion tons a year going in the ocean of carbon. That's 2 times 3.66 tons of carbon dioxide going in 1985. Right now, the ocean is taking up about 25 million tons of carbon dioxide a day going in the surface ocean. And the trees, sometimes they absorb carbon dioxide and sometimes they give it up. in an atmospheric, in a carbon cycle model, the trees are a decay function. There's a carbon goes in and the trees grow and then they die and rot and it comes out again. And the box has a certain size and the lag time in that box is about 40 years. Diagrams like this aren't a lot of use for where we have to go next. Now, what have we learned over the last 40 years? Well, an enormous amount. But for the purposes of this lecture, we'll compress it into a very small set of view graphs. Carbon dioxide's gone up. There's the Mauna Loa measurement sequence. The little wiggles are the annual vegetative changes. And we're driving CO2 up. The 7 billion tons of carbon are going into the, are being burned each year. And the atmospheric CO2 levels are rising dramatically. And then in the 1980s and the 1990s, a heroic set of work on the ice cores began, and the wonderful record of carbon dioxide changes in prehistoric times. Here's the last 400,000 years shown, where as the glacial cycles have come and gone, temperatures changed and CO2 has changed with it. And the little red thing at the end right there is where we are today. In fact, we're slightly higher than that red dot. We've now exceeded the CO2 levels in any time in the last, say, 500,000 years. And so all of this has been meticulously documented by some superb people, with wonderful measurements, vast numbers of climate models, and it's a tremendous history. And I believe all of it. If you want to look at the industrial era, this is a paper from Jim Hansen. CO2 is not the only one. Methane, N2O, and the chlorofluorocarbons also force atmosphere. And the methane record is particularly interesting. We're not going to talk about it today. That's another lecture, Tony. But from the ice cores and the modern record, we're putting the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere in recent times. And they're forcing, the atmospheric forcing is known well. These are the climate forcings in watts per meter squared over the Earth's surface. And at double atmospheric CO2, which is the number everybody sort of uses as a yardstick, it's about 4 watts per square meter forcing. Now, this is small compared to the vast fluctuations that go on between day and night and the seasons, but it's incremental, and it does have its effect. And these are all the other things which people have worked out, the volcanic aerosols, cloud changes, and so on. But the net result is, yes, indeed, we are forcing the atmosphere. And the rates at which we're forcing it are changing. And the biggest change in rate is carbon dioxide. And this is the delta F in watts per meter squared per year. And the biggest signal is CO2, and it's going up, up, and up. And so that's the tall pole in the tent. And that's what's driving the changes in our planet.
What account for the dips?
That was World War II, I think. And other things like it. Now, Tony asked for some small amount of physics. This is from a nice paper by Jim Hansen. And the message is a sobering one. You don't get warming instantly. The planet has a heat capacity, and we get large time lags. If you considered a simple black body planet, and then you subjected it to a change in solar forcing, so you expose it to a change in radiation, then it will have a climate feedback factor. It will respond with some lag time depending on its feedback, and we'll call it F. And you could estimate with the back of the envelope calculation that if, for instance, F was 3, that is a doubling of greenhouse gases, give you a 3-degree change, and you had a swamp ocean with a depth of 100 meters, you know, its heat capacity, then the delay time will be about 10 years. But the ocean mix layer, the ocean surface convex and mixes with the deep ocean. Only 70% of the planet is ocean, the rest is land. It's got its own effects. And you simply go through the algorithms. And what you come up with is that with various models be calibrated, that the lag time for the planet is at least 30 years. And we have a large amount of unrealized global warming. And the temperature signal we're getting today is one you bought into when you put the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere in the 1970s. And so already we've bought into the last 30 years of greenhouse gas emissions We just haven't felt the temperature yet. And as we go forward, this gets bigger. And in fact, if we take the most recent estimates of the temperature changes from doubling of CO2, the temperature sensitivity is slightly more than 1.5 degrees. I would say this might move up to about 40 years right now. So we've already bought the farm in a way. We've locked ourselves into this warming process, which is underway. And it's the devil's own job, of course, to decide exactly how much that is going to be and how much attention you should pay to it and what the cost of that is. Now, so far this is all theory. You've got to move to observations. And can you measure these changes, or is this hype? And of course you can. This was one paper, it was by Mann et al. I used it in a lecture recently, showing a reconstruction of Northern Hemisphere temperature anomaly. They went through an elaborate filtering procedure. It's a well-respected paper. Temperature drifted downwards for about 1,000 years. Nobody really knows why, but the best bet is it was because of deforestation. As mankind grew, we cut down the forests. That changed the albedo of the planet. We got more bright land surface. We reflected more heat into space. And around this time, the greenhouse gases took over. The Industrial Revolution occurred, and forests began to grow back. And
yeah. Why is the more the minimum of visible there?
It's not that well seen anyway, and the smoothing they went through removes some of those forcing effects. So this is a smooth data set taking into account some of the known solar and other effects, and volcanic forcing and so on. So it's become, for many years it was unfashionable to do that, you had to deal with the raw data. But in order to clarify things, there's now quite a number of papers where you explicitly take out the known functions. Yeah, and this was a perfectly good one, and you can see that the modern temperature sticks out like a spike, and it's right there. Now, I'm an ocean scientist, and almost all of the heat and almost all of the carbon dioxide finishes up in the ocean. So can you measure it? Yeah, the ocean's getting warmer. This is from a paper in Science by Sid Levitas and colleagues. Sid is a master craftsman in our field. He's the guy who compiles the data for the atlases, has an unimpeachable reputation. Anybody in our field will not mess with Sid's data sets. They're wonderful. So when this comes along, it's the right stuff. This is the world ocean from 1945 to 1995. There's the line. And these are the various hemispheres, Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, Indian Ocean, Atlantic, and so on. This is data mining carried out wonderfully well. These numbers are heat content in joules, and the world ocean is assimilated about 10 to the 23 joules of heat, rather more than that now because it's gone up since this paper was written. You can do the calculation rather simply. That is about 100 times more than all the heat liberated when the fuel was first burned. So if you think of all the blast furnaces and race cars and kitchen stoves in the world going full blast and multiply it by 100 and put them all at the bottom of the ocean, or top of the ocean, that's how much heat we're putting in. Now, of course, planetary folks like to point out, well, if we just turned the sun off for a few minutes, we'd get the changes in this scale, but you don't do that. These are cumulative changes. And so the heat content of the ocean is going up big time, and that signal has been well modeled, and it matches theory. Is the other part of the equation, the carbon dioxide, going in the ocean? Yes. I wrote the first paper on that in 25 years ago and laid out the elementary algorithms for how to extract the small CO2 signal from the large ocean background, and it's a cottage industry today. This is the Atlantic Ocean. There's the North Atlantic. There's the South Atlantic. These two are theoretical models. Those two are analyses of data. That's the carbon dioxide anomaly. And you can see this tracer. It's a dye we're putting into the atmosphere, and it's mixing down in the ocean, being convected to very deep depths in the North Atlantic Ocean. Last week, I got a paper to review on this signal in the Pacific. It's a review copy. I am going to recommend they publish with some changes. This shows the radiocarbon signal, the carbon dioxide signal, and the chlorofluorocarbons, the freons, as tracers. So we have a difficult to measure tracer, the CO2 versus two well-known ones. The signals correlate beautifully. The upper ocean has now got about 50 micromoles per kilogram more CO2 than it used to. That's about 2.5 milligrams per kilogram. A graduate student or a high school student with a good balance and skills could weigh the difference. It's big. And that's the result of our putting right now millions of tons of a day in the ocean surface. This can be modeled by elaborate equations and vast geophysical fluid dynamic models. But if you want a take-home message, the Industrial Revolution is about 100 years old. That signal's down around 1,200 meters. That front here is moving down about a meter a month. Last time I heard it was like 17 meters a year. By the year 2050, 50 years from now, we'll be down another 600 meters. Now, models might modify it a bit, but not a lot. You know, it's going to work out like that. So already down at 1 kilometer and soon down to 1,500 kilometers, the dye, the pH invasion, the CO2 invasion of the 20th and now the 21st century is working its way down. So we don't have a pristine deep ocean. We've got a labeled one. Yeah, this is basic geophysical fluid dynamics, the subtropical gyres, where we have the deepening of the thermocline. The equatorial divergence is where we have the water masses pulling apart. Water's moved to the right of the wind in the northern hemisphere, to the left in the southern. At the equator, they diverge, they pull the water up. We get lower penetration. There's actually, as a subtlety, there's a fairly large flux here. There's just not a large standing crop because the water that goes in there goes off along the isopycnal surfaces and gets transported off to the left and right. So it's actually quite a good reason, a region of invasion, just that the water doesn't pile up there because of the motions. So you're seeing the result of world geophysical fluid dynamics. This is just the result of sprinkling a dye on the surface for 100 years, and we're measuring the integrated signal. Now, if you read the newspapers, everything is about global warming. In my view, that is going to emerge as only a small part of the signal. The chemical insult that we're driving the upper ocean is beginning to cause problems. This is a paper I wrote where we simply compute the chemistry of surface seawater through time. Start with the year 1800, and we have these bicarbonate and carbonate ion properties. And we simply move forward in time along with the predictions of the IPCC reports, the so-called business as usual. By the year 2100, we'll have driven the atmosphere up to about 800 parts per million. And the carbonate ion, the stuff that coral reefs are made of, calcium carbonate, has dropped by 55%. So we're making the water, ocean water, more acidic. We're titrating the carbonate ion that's there. We're increasing the bicarbonate ion. And that 55% change in carbonate ion is a vastly bigger fractional change than the relatively small change in temperature. And it's beginning to have its effects. The sleeping oasis are probably the coral reefs. Most of the discussion has been about coral bleaching, which is pretty much believed to be a thermal effect. This is a nice review of that. Coral bleaching, the corals go white. And that is associated with temperature. It's still a bit of a mystery, but the best bet is that it's to do with the photosynthetic apparatus of the zooxanthellae, which exists within the corals and give them their energy. And it's thought to be the dark reaction, which is affected by temperature. And there's been a large amount of exploration of this. So as the ocean gets warmer and temperature extremes come and go, the coral reefs are less able to tolerate it. They bleach and die. And we are very much at the upper level at which many corals can take this. More recently, independent of the temperature, the fact that the ocean is getting more acidic is also having its effect. Corals are two parts, zooxanthellae, which photosynthesize, and calcium carbonate skeletons. And this is a paper appeared in Science, which was pretty much theoretical. And they just took the number I gave you, how much carbonate ion has gone, and suggested by the time we double atmospheric CO2, it will change the precipitation by up to 30% precipitation of calcium carbonate in corals. Theory is okay. Anybody can do a calculation, but there is data. This was a group at Lamont and Hawaii published in Global Biogeochemical Cycles. And they had a large tank in Hawaii with some coral reef systems in it. And they would dose it up with hydrochloric acid to simulate the pH changes of CO2. And they made experimental measurements on this very complex system. It's a long paper. You have a lot to read here, but here's the text at the bottom. Based on our long-term decrease in data, we believe that there'll be a 40% change in coral reef calcium carbonate assimilation by the time we double atmospheric CO2. The previous work said 14 to 30%. That was the last paper. We think it's more. And so your coral reefs are getting a double whammy, the temperature effect, which is causing the bleaching, and the chemical effect, which is in fact larger, causing the slowdown in calcification. So even those who say, well, global warming is not so bad, you know, what's so bad about having a warmer Earth? If we keep changing the chemistry, we're going to get into trouble.
What role does the coral reef play in the food chain of the ocean?
Well, it's enormous, yeah.
It's enormous.
But of course, in the tropics, yes. Yeah. But also in human livelihood. I serve on an ICSU body which deals with science in the Pacific Island nations. I was at a coral reef symposium. Mm-hmm. I gave a talk like this, and tremendous concern among all the Pacific Islanders. Mm-hmm. What's not been done yet is an actual live coral reef experiment, and it would be hard to do because you're dealing with a complex ecosystem, but it should be done. And I would submit to you that because we have this 30 or 40 year lag time for warming, whereas the carbon CO2 effects are immediate, that might be a better hook for politicians to fasten on as to when it's important to make a decision.
What's the estimated extent of the coral reef?
I don't have that number for you, but it's a function of the health of the reef and a number of other things, but it affects maybe 20% of coral reefs worldwide, I would think. I don't believe I've got the paper in my bag, but I can give you the reference. Now, we move to the next part of the talk, which is what scientists propose to do about this. And in my view, this is where we've let ourselves down. And the dialogue has not been wise or helpful. It's not been carried out at the same level as the beautiful and sophisticated work on climate modeling, which has gone on so far. And it's a great pity, because that's what people care about, and frankly, it's going to be where the money is. These are big issues. And at the time of the Kyoto Protocol and all those other meetings, the terrestrial scientists kind of carried the day and got all the newspaper headlines. And this paper appeared in Science by some of my well-respected colleagues, Jorge Sarmiento and Taro Takahashi and Peter Tantz. And Science published this very aggressively to coincide at the same week as one of these international meetings. And it said, hey, you know, we should plant trees. And the U.S. is in good shape because we have a lot of forests. And we've done an analysis. North American vegetation takes up 1.7 petagrams of carbon per year. That's 17 billion tons of carbon a year. The rest of the world only takes up, Eurasia and North America takes up 0.1. So North America, south of 51 degrees north, is 17 times better than the entire rest of the Northern Hemisphere in soaking up CO2. So we're clean. And this was used by our political folks to lobby very hard for growing trees and we're the good guys. Now, this would offset all our emissions. It's because of the enthusiasm of the moment and the great pressure to find a terrestrial solution that papers like this appeared. And the trouble is it wasn't right. You know, it's just not 17 times more important than the rest of the world. The world's more evenly balanced than that. And everybody else weighed in, and pretty soon, again, in Science, there's a whole bunch of papers saying, well, guys, you've got it wrong. You know, the analysis wasn't the way you say it was. And everybody began revising those numbers downwards very quickly. This was last year's paper, Superweeds and a Sinking Feeling on Carbon Sinks. Guys, we got it wrong. And in fact, carbon storage in forests is not that permanent. As the world gets warmer, tropical forests are beginning to give up carbon, not assimilate it. And there's been a huge backing off on this idea. And it presents us with a big political problem.
Why is it giving off carbon dioxide?
Well, tropical forests are about stress. They can't, they're at their temperature limit. And they can't, as thermal effects come and go, El Nino events and so on, they're beginning to show decreases in growth rates with the thermal, which correlate with the temperature changes. And also the numerical, basically, this was a large inversion on a data set that produced that estimate. The data were, other people have done that inversion with different boundary conditions and got different results. It was optimistic to suggest that they would have got that.
Well, you said earlier, though, it's a steady state process, right? Sucking up carbon and decaying and releasing carbon.
So, well, it is if the terrestrial vegetation is in steady state. We cut down most of the forests in the pre-industrial revolution time to make grazing space for horses, then it grew back again. Then we started logging the tropical forests, and then they grew back again. And so it's a fluid system.
In
the long run, it's a steady state. The only way you get permanent carbon removal if you cut down the trees and then you stack them up in the Antarctic or something. Or you build houses. Yeah? Now, independent of all of this activity, there's been a separate attack, and this is the other part of the talk, which has been almost entirely neglected by the carbon and climate change community. And it's very sad that these divisions occur. And this is the nasty, mean industrial solution. Now, this was a very good report by the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology in 97 to President Clinton on an energy future for the nation. And I began to look at this and get kind of interested. This is what's called Vision 21. And the idea is we're going to solve the CO2 problem not by growing trees, but by stopping CO2 going in the atmosphere. And the idea is that you're taking coal or something like that, you convert it to gas, you get hydrogen out, you go to a fuel cell, and CO2 goes off to sequestration. If you read the newspapers last week, the Bush administration agreed, due to industry pressure, to back away from the high mileage conventional automobile and substitute instead a fuel cell technology goal for the future, delivering hydrogen to the nation's gas stations. You take your car and you fill it with hydrogen. That is a implementation of this philosophy from the PCAST report. You put in coal, you get out hydrogen, you take off the carbon dioxide, you don't dump it in the atmosphere, you put it somewhere else. On the next page, they were good enough to tell us where else. They wanted a science-based CO2 sequestration program in cooperation with the industry with an annual budget up to $20 million or more. And they suggested that we should put it either underground or in the ocean. In fact, this budget is already beyond $20 million before we've got to 2003. And their particular vision was that in addition to getting energy out of the ocean from the methane hydrates, we would put carbon dioxide in the ocean and also store it as a hydrate. CO2 hydrate will be the sequestered state of the gas. So you'll build your gas plant, you'll produce hydrogen, you'll send it off to your fuel cell. The CO2 will go out in a big pipeline and we'll put it underground or in the ocean. And it's about the point that we come in. And I began to be very curious about that because it's my ocean and I've been measuring it for 40 years and I like to think we know something about it. So we began to ask questions, well, how much? How are you going to do this? What's the science? What does it look like? What are these hydrates? Now first, just to give you a feel for the numbers, when I give these talks, everybody says, you know, please, you know, I'm in favor of conservation. You know, fluorescent light bulbs are the things, or you know, put more insulation in your home, or you know, my car gets 25 miles to the gallon, and so on. I'm a conservationist too. That's not going to cut it. And here's the numbers. Here is the so-called business as usual curve, IPCC. If we implemented the Kyoto Agreement, which we've not, we do diddly squat. Change that a little bit. Even that Kyoto number is too much for our politicians to buy because it would really hurt the economy because the numbers are big. Now the problem with that curve, which everybody cites, is it's not business as usual. It is in fact a very clean world, which is the most enlightened society you can think of. For instance, it assumes that in 100 years, renewable and nuclear technologies will provide 75% of all power. Right now, they provide 24%. And non-carbon technologies, solar and wind, will 100 years from now be twice the size of the entire global energy system we have today. And energy consumed per unit of economic activity, our efficiency, will be a factor of 3 greater than it is now. If you do all of those things, which we aren't doing, you will get the curve, which means we'll double atmospheric CO2 levels by the year 2050. And there's nothing to stop us. Doubling is just a slogan. It'll be 40%, I mean, the 40% increase, it'll be a doubling, it'll be tripling, it'll be a quadrupling. It just keeps going up. And so even though it's politically unpalatable to say, that's not good enough, the problem is that we're nowhere near achieving that IPCC curve, which is so green. That's that curve. this is business as usual for 1990s technology. And frankly, that's a lot closer to the curve we're on now. So all the numbers I've given you are pretty much an underestimate, a low ball. And so to say we've got to change light bulbs and so on is not going to cut it. We need bigger numbers. There's many papers published on this now. They're all well accepted. I could give you a citation, but this is a little recitation. If you set a goal of holding atmosphere CO2 levels at double, why double? I don't know. It's everybody's favorite number, but it might be 2.1, it might be 1.9, it might be 3. We just scale it. Then we've got to deviate from our present trend by about 3.7 billion tons of CO2 a year by 2025, and about 14.6 by 2050. That's to try and hold things constant. And you can do that by going nuclear, by being more efficient, or instead of putting CO2 in the air, you put it underground or in the ocean. And that way you stop it building up in the atmosphere. Well, let's give equal shares to all. I mean, we'll have all the conservationists say you get a third of that. You get a billion tons a year, and we'll take the nuclear people and say you can get a billion tons a year, and we'll take the disposal folks and say you can have a billion. You know, those are targets to go for, and those are big numbers. The U.S. share of global energy turns out to be about 25%. So, if we split that number in three and then we took 25%, then we would have a target of about 0.3 billion tons a year of CO2 by 2025. And you could put that underground or in the ocean. Let's just take three quarters underground and one quarter in the ocean. Now, that's still about 0.2 million tons a day we'd have to put in there. So a little bit, it could be a lot more. There is no technology in place for doing this. These numbers are only just beginning to be talked about. They're huge numbers. Just calculate the size of the pipeline to deliver this much stuff. The company that's doing it is McDermott Technologies out in Ohio. They have a big barge pipe and a pipeline company. And the chemical engineering of this is being discussed in small groups. And the numbers are really very large. Now, I'm not saying we're going to do this. I'm just saying that in order to be honest, those are the numbers. Now, when we took a look at this, what I found was that the science, the chemical science of the ocean science, was really kind of weird. Not because the people were bad, but because there were no experimental resources, and you would invite good scientists to a meeting and say, well, what do you think we should do? And they say, well, I'd put it in the ocean. How would you do that? And they'd pick up a number two pencil and draw a diagram. And for about a decade, we had this cartoon sketch science, because there was no resources to do anything else. So we got a whole bunch of cartoons in the literature, and they're very engaging. And this is very nice one from Golum in UMass Lowell, who's a very nice guy. And he probably regrets drawing this picture, but it's a charming one to show. And I like him a lot. Here's a power plant and a pipe. And there's some kind of mixer. And snowballs fall out of the bottom. And those are the hydrates which are mentioned in the presidential report. And we're going to sequester it, so they're going to stay there. Okay? So we're going to make blocks of ice on the seafloor. Now, for other reasons, I've taken a look at this, and these are very beautiful compounds. A hydrate is a solid. You mix gas and water at high pressure and low temperature, and they condense to form a solid. They're either van der Waals solids or hydrogen-bonded solids, whichever you look at it. The green lines there are the hydrogen bonds. The red balls are gas molecules like CO2 and methane. The gas molecule is in a cage, like a bird in a cage, and it's electrostatically the two sides are holding each other in check. You look at the Raman spectra of that. It retains the characteristics of a modified gas molecule. It's vibrating inside that cage. And these things are beautiful, clear solids like ice. Methane hydrates are present in enormous quantities in the world. And CO2 will also form a hydrate just like that. Remember the first slide I showed you, the color question mark? This was from that paper. This was their idea. We can either put in a pipeline, the droplets float up, can have a very long pipe, and the drops fall down. I'll have more about that later. These crazy guys are dropping blocks of dry ice over, which would be ridiculously expensive. And there's a lake of CO2 on the seafloor, and there's this imagination about what could be done.
Can you say a few more words about the properties of these hydrates? What's the melting temperature?
I could say a great deal.
No.
And Hydrates have many of the physical properties of ice. That's where you begin. That is, although their thermal conductivity is far lower. In the ocean outside here, if you inject carbon dioxide into the ocean at a depth of about 350 meters, it will react with the ocean to form a solid ice. And I will show you the phase diagram. But basically, as you go down, given the temperature profile of the ocean, you first go from a gas to a liquid around about 300, given the temperature at around 300 meters, 30 bars. The gas would also form a hydrate. You form a hydrate at about 300, 350 meters. And we've done the experiments. I'm going to show you some pictures. So we decided right about this point that enough of cartoons. We ought to do an experiment. Our lab has ships and an undersea vehicle, and I thought we ought to use them to try and do this. It was very radical. So we went out in the boat one day, and we had a tank of carbon dioxide gas, and some pipes and some valves, and I thought we would do an experiment to see what the reality was behind all these cartoons and presidential panels. So let's show you some pictures. Now, put the power on. It'll come up. Photons are coming. And there was a great deal of mystery about this. People had done pressure vessel experiments, but nobody had actually been in the ocean and done this. But we were determined to try and see what it would look like in Mother Nature. So, play. And this is a depth of 600 meters. That's a robotic arm out there on the left, on the right. I'm on a ship in a nice warm control room. This is a robotically operated vehicle. We're communicating with it down a fiber optic cable. That's a 4-liter glass beaker, which we're holding out. And there's a tube in there, and I'm going to inject some CO2. And there we are. That, I think, is the world's first ocean CO2 disposal experiment. And we're injecting liquid CO2, and that white, shiny effect is the hydrate. That's the ice-like solid forming on the skin of the CO2. Now, it's supposed to sink. Remember the snowballs on the on the seafloor? Well, it doesn't sink. And, of course, the reason for that is we don't get a chunk of ice. We get more like a ping-pong ball. You get a skin of ice on the outside. Diffusion through that is slow. You've got a little droplet of liquid CO2 inside, and the reaction stops. And we were able to visualize this. No matter what we did, we couldn't make it sink. Now, I would point out that there's great scope for chemical engineering changes here. We're doing the pH measurement in there with the electrode upside down, 200 ROV work, 600 meters below the surface. And the group at Oak Ridge have done what we've talked about doing. They've redesigned the nozzle so it will come out like toothpaste and sink. This is at 800 meters. We're trying our best to get enough water CO2 mixing, and we're getting cotton candy made. And that bright white reflection is those molecular hydrates forming. And they're forming as a skin again on the solid, and we can't make this sink. And so what would happen is you would do all this work of taking it down in a pipe, you'd inject it, and it would float back up towards the surface, and it would undo a lot of the work that you'd done to put it in. So we need to cure that. Let's stop this. And can you just put a lens cap on that for a second? I'm sure. So I'm going to walk you through some of this. We looked at the equation of state. Seawater itself is highly incompressible. Liquid CO2 is highly compressible. And although the stuff would float near the surface, it sinks as you go deeper. Here's the density of seawater as a function of pressure. There's the density of liquid CO2. The crossover points at around 300 bars or 3,000 meters in the ocean. In fact, we can compute it rather precisely. And so we sat down with some high-quality hydrographic data and a rather fine piece of software. And the neutrally buoyant point would be about 2,750 meters. And these curved lines are the liquid CO2 equation of state. This line is the equation of state of seawater. We began to model it fairly precisely. And we decided we'd go down below this point, and we would do a gravitationally stable experiment. So instead of the stuff floating up, it would stay down there. Again, we used our vehicle. This is a moon pool. That door opens up, and the ocean's under your feet. This is a 3-ton remotely operated vehicle, which is worth quite a lot of money. That's a tank of carbon dioxide. It's my colleague loading it up. And we simply load the carbon dioxide into a large steel accumulator. Think of it as a big hypodermic syringe made of steel that'll take about 1,000 psi. And as we go down, we're going to keep pushing on the accumulator, so we always keep it in the liquid state, and we're doing a pressure balance experiment. And then when we get down to the seafloor, we're going to open a valve and put some pressure on the accumulator, and we're going to expel some gas experimentally. And it turned out to be very hard. As you go down, the temperatures and pressures are constantly changing, and it requires a lot of nursing to make this experiment work. First time we tried it, we got the valving wrong. We froze everything up with hydrate. Instead of getting the CO2 in the ocean, we got the ocean and the CO2. We made everything into a great block of ice. We brought it up, we undid the end cap, and stuff was flying everywhere. The pilots were amazed. But here is our C4 experiment, and we found things were very different. And this is where the rather strange geophysical fluid dynamics comes into play. Here our famous 4-liter beaker is the right way up. We're at 3,600 meters. It's taken us a couple of hours to get down there. That's a Tigon tube. There's some mud in it. The pilots are so good, they could just flick it off on the side of the beaker. And then I open up the valve, and we do a little work. And you see in the world's first really deep ocean CO2 disposal experiment, just like the presidential report said. Thermodynamics works. The stuff is more dense. It does sink. We get all the equations right. And there's little animals there watching us. And it turns out that there was a whole bunch of theory applied to this. Basically, the expectation was that we would get a skin of hydrate ice, much like ice on a pond. This would armor the surface, and it would slowly, slowly, slowly dissolve. It would maybe take forever. So we kind of expected that. The first experiment is a beaker with a glass bottom. This is a tube pushed into the mud, and so the sea floor forms the bottom here. It's in contact with the sediment. And we forgot to label this one. We didn't have a beaker. Those are inches, and the other one's in centimeters. So these are not very nice physical units. And we also scraped a hole on the seafloor and laid some CO2 eggs in it. And this is a free release experiment. And you know, all this is great fun to do because it's the first time anybody had seen this. And we were saying, wow, would you look at that, you? We came back. It took us a couple of hours to do all this. And we came back to our beaker and said, well, wait a minute. We put about 2.5 liters in there. It should have gone down. We got more. So, you know, how much did you put in? Well, I thought you were taking the notes on that. Well, no, it wasn't my job. It was your job, you know. And we began to argue. We put about 2.5 inches into this tube. We're now up around 7. We realized our experiment was going backwards. And so we weren't anywhere near as clever as we thought we were. And after about an hour, we realized we couldn't contain the experiment. And we got the incredible expanding CO2, and it was overflowing. And these are very beautiful, like those really Taylor instabilities there. What we were getting was a complete reversal of expectations. And you can begin to see at the bottom, the video is kind of washed out in this projection, but the slush, ice-like slush building up at the bottom. We got 14 overflow events, went like clockwork. And so we're getting a self-generating convective instability here, the fluid dynamics of which are still not well understood today, although there are a number of papers on this. And we began to realize that nature might be more complex than we thought. This tube had about 2.5 inches in. It's a 12-inch tall tube. We managed to fill that, so there's more than a factor of 6 increase in volume. We did an inadvertent biological experiment, and so that fish is about 2 feet long, and it comes up and looks at it and goes away again. And this is like Teflon. It rolls around on the seafloor. And the big paper was speculating on intense reactions with the sediment, and we didn't seem to see that. This stuff kept going, and we began to see, you can see the ice building up at the bottom. What we think we've got here is an ice storm, where one molecule of CO2 is reacting with 6 molecules of water to form a hydrate. That gives you a volume increase. The solid is more dense than the liquid and falls to the bottom. This little guy has no eyes. He doesn't know what he's getting into. But he goes by within a couple of centimeters of this witch's brew, and this begins to tell us that there are not massive great chemical gradients propagating. They're very close. And the reason for that is probably extreme density of the boundary layer. This 12-inch tall beaker filled up, and you can see that shimmering on the surface. That's probably the ice storm taking place, where we're getting a hail storm down to the bottom. And eventually this two overflowed, so we had about a factor of six increase in volume. And these convective instabilities were quite extraordinary. We estimated we probably got at least a factor of 10 increase. The theoretical value for pure solid would be a factor of 3.5. And so it tells us we're not making a pure solid. We've got brine inclusions and trapped fluid and all kinds of things. And you can see it pulling back there due to its surface tension. The exact physical description of this has still not been worked out. I can give you papers in the Journal of Crystal Growth, papers in Japanese engineering publications. What I would say is that we repeated this experiment and we did not get the same effect. So we have some examples of chaotic behavior in which small changes in initiation of the experiment can lead to differences in outcome. We're not quite sure why. Here's a lid of the hydrate ice on the surface, because just like a volcano, the magma's come up and spilled over and then gone down again, left a hat. The blobs of CO2 on the seafloor, we put down there, they expanded, and pretty soon they got too big, and a passing eddy came by and rolled them away. It was very hard. We're on a slight slope, and it was hard to maintain things. That's a temperature sensor inside a metal cage, so we don't break it when we bang it into things. We put it in to see if the temperature was the same inside as outside, and of course it was. The ocean's an awfully good heat sink. And when it came out, it's got these beautiful ice crystals, kind of like a cocktail swizzle stick coming out. And those are those transparent crystals of the hydrates, which I showed you. And they do sink, they're more dense than the ocean water. After about 12 hours, it was time to come home. We'd actually burned out a thruster motor. The machine wasn't designed to sit still that long. And so we grabbed the stuff, and of course, the beaker on the left there has got a bottom. The one on the right does not. And all that solid crystalline material in the air fell out through the bottom. And there's a pillar of CO2 hydrate, just like that cartoon sketch we saw, which we sat on the seafloor, and we kind of poked at it with the lead ball, which held our marker, and it fell over. And we left it there. And of course, the original idea of the presidential report was we'd store stuff in this form, implying permanence, and we realized very early on it would dissolve, but nobody knew the rate. So let's stop that now. And if we can have that tape off, I might take it out. Now, I'm running short of time, Tony, so I'll have to be quick. You're getting the flavor here. Let me just tell you a few things. Experiments of that class defined the phase boundary and some of the geophysical fluid dynamics. They did not get us the rates. And so the next phase of our experiment was to try and get the rates of these processes, and we've had to get very creative. This was classical physics of the simplest kind. What we did was to inject a droplet of seawater into the ocean at, say, 800 meters. This is an imaging box. It's got a black back, so we don't see jellyfish, which look remarkably like bits of CO2. We lit it well. We had a scale in there. We injected the droplets. They began to float upwards, and we flew a 3-ton vehicle up at the same speed as the drop, just keeping it in view, so that we got the bubble instabilities and the correct hydrodynamics to try and get any effects of hydrate skin thickening or thinning or dissolution. It worked wonderfully well. The pilots were terrified. Fly a 3-ton vehicle up for half an hour, keeping a 1 centimeter or less droplet in view all the time. That's what it looks like out the front of the camera. There's a nozzle. You can hardly see them, but there's a drops of CO2. We then process the data. It's a Sony HDTV camera. And those are two droplets of carbon dioxide floating upwards through the ocean. There's a scale at the back. We correct for parallax and a number of other things. We get pretty good quantitative data. And from that, you simply get the shrinkage rate of the drop due to dissolution. And it turns out that the drop dissolution rate is 3 micromoles per centimeter squared per second. And that number is being used by the Norwegian group, who are doing some very fine analyses of injection of CO2 into the ocean at intermediate depths off Norway. And it gives a plume at a certain column. What it means is that 90% of the mass loss occurs within half an hour, with about 200 meters at the injection point. And so that helps you design a release. For the C4, it's much harder to get rates. And Tony, I could say more. I'm going to wrap up. I'll just show you one more videotape.
You can go past.
Is that because you like the pictures?
Yeah.
Once the stuff is sinking, you can't do the bubble shaking experiment, so we had to get creative. So we went down to where the CO2 was stable, and by this time we knew something about what the theoretical limit should be. If it's 3 micromoles per centimeter squared per second at shallow depths, it's governed by the thickness of this hydrate skin on the surface. The compressibility of the solid is not large. We compute the solubility. We figured it should change by about a factor of 2. And here we did an experiment this summer where we punched a hole in the seafloor and poured some liquid CO2 in it. And this is kind of like a plant or a mushroom. It's been held in place by the stem under the ground, so this blob doesn't roll away. And then we took a pH electrode and slowly touched it on the surface. And instead of it then becoming wet with liquid CO2, the surface deformed. If you think of a balloon full of water, and you push your finger in, then you get a cavity in the surface of the balloon. It stretches. That's the elastic properties of the skin. In this case, this is brittle like ice, so it cannot have an elastic strength. What we're getting is a rebuilding of the membrane. And I'll show a cartoon of that. But that is a water pocket which we formed. And that pH electrode is sitting inside seawater. And that seawater is slowly getting labeled as the carbon dioxide around it dissolves into that drop. And the mechanics of this and the surface tension have been worked out by our Japanese colleagues, Kenji Yamani and Izo Iyer. And they produced a nice video clip, which I didn't bring down. But basically, a hydrate skin like this with water molecules on the outside and CO2 on the inside, microscopic cracks are forced in the surface. The water on the outside floods in. Yes, the CO2 on the inside floods in. They meet in the middle. And the hydrate rebuilding is sufficiently fast that you can deform that surface and just it gets rebuilt as fast as you put it in. Now, we were able to use this. And in fact, we extended the observations of this group by a factor of 4. And we got this result. And in fact, the net result was that the dissolution rate of CO2 at 3,000 meters was about a factor of 2.5 less than that at 800 meters. And it matches very well with theory. So really, in a few days of ship time, we put to rest presidential panel concerns and storage of CO2. We measured statistics of dissolution rates and so on. But we uncovered some disturbing things, and that is the rate processes which govern many of these things are very badly known. We repeated the Beaker experiment, and we did not get the overflow event. We don't know if that's due to strange effects of contaminant species, or if it's due to a chaotic effect where small changes in initial conditions initiate some convective instabilities that we're not quite sure of. But you have liquid CO2, the solid hydrate, the seawater, including brine. You've got at least 3 components which are interacting. You've got the recipe for trouble. Now, to give you a further example, if I look at this curve, which I did, first thing that struck me is there's too much carbon dioxide. This goes up to 2 molar. It's supersaturated by a factor of 3 for the equation of state. So we have the ability to generate supersaturated solutions. And why that happened, we don't know. But it does have some strange effects. And let me show you. Let's put this off, and we'll put on this videotape. This was an experiment we did last summer. That's a time-lapse camera. The camera lens is stuck up top. The yellow dome just houses the battery packs and the video recorder. That's a corral of liquid CO2. Those legs just hold it at the right focal length from the camera. And here we are dispensing liquid CO2 on the seafloor. And there's some cages out there for putting animals in. And our biological colleague, Jim Barry, collects animals, and we put them close by. Because obviously, there are severe environmental concerns about dumping CO2 on the seafloor. How bad is it going to be for marine life? And the answer might not be pretty. We need to know that. That's a pH electrode. We're measuring the local pH, the gradient. There's the ubiquitous fish. They always come and look at what we do. And the idea was we would take animals and put them in these cages and return a month later and see if they'd survived. This fish hung around for about a full 5 minutes. I kept the camera on here for quite a bit. No matter what we did, he just kept chowing down on the sediment we disturbed. You could see from the reflectance that there is a hydrate film, a thin film forming there as you pile the stuff in. We've done a hydrodynamic analysis of those ripples, and it tells us something about the surface tension of that material, which is rather odd. And for the fluid dynamicists, I expect we have huge discontinuities across the surface, and that the water side is very different to the CO2 side because of the differences in viscosity. We thought that was the Beaker effect, where that corral had overflowed. We topped it up and came back an hour later, and look at all that CO2 lying there. It wasn't, it was something much more mundane. This is another shot. As the vehicle lifted off the seafloor, the propellers produced backwash, and we washed out some of the stuff. So although these fluids look like they're sitting there, the delta density is not that large. You've got to be real careful how you do the experiment. If we looked at the time-lapse camera, it was hard to get a lot because the lighting wasn't good enough. But there was a speculation that if you put CO2 on the seafloor, animals would get curious and come up, and they would die. The dead animal would attract another dead animal, which would also come up and die. And it was rather like this lake in Lake Neos in Africa, where they had CO2 events. And pretty soon we'd have a wall of death, and this was the environmental fear. And so we put this corral out there, and we put this time-lapse camera on it. We need to get better lighting and so on. Truth is, nothing interesting happened. We had, 14 days of video, and animals would come up and get in focus or out of focus and swim by or not. Nothing happened. No animals croaked. Little bit of sediment, that's a fish out of focus looking in the camera and then going away again. We need a better camera. But I want you to realize that if I was to take the dissolution rate I computed from that pH measurement, then we set the camera for about the right length of time to record the eventual disappearance of that mass. And so the numbers are working, we know how to do the experiments. And slowly, I'm just taking brief clips here and there when something happens, ripples or fish going by, the material just disappeared. And so the storage on the seafloor would not work. We've got to put it in the ocean circulation. Now, as it goes around, the mean circulation down the ocean is 500 years. So it will get re-exposed to the atmosphere down the road. When that happens, the very fact that the ocean is an alkaline system works for you. It piles up in the atmosphere because it's slow to go in the ocean because of the buffer factor. Once it gets re-exposed, for the same reason, very little of it gets back out because of the relative size of the reservoirs. And the full-scale efficiency of this with a full ocean ventilation model is about 85%. As almost all of the CO2 stays in the ocean. Now, to give you an example of a chaotic problem, we just saw a videotape where nothing happened with marine sediments for 14 days. 20 meters away, we did a separate experiment. This is experiment number 2. That was the bottom of the barrel. That's like pouring the wine out, that little bit of hydrate that occurred at the end. We came back 24 hours later. This thing had crystallized into a solid mass, and its partner 20 meters away had not. And we don't know why. All I can tell you is that on this occasion, we generated supersaturated fluids. They migrated down into the pore waters because of their extreme density. They then crystallized in the pore waters and formed a solid. It thrust up and made a frost heave. You cut that video off now. Why that happened in one case and did not happen in the other, we don't know. We can speculate, but we don't know. Now, I can show you more videos. Anybody wants more, I can show you some more. Tony told me I had an hour, so.
Well, a few more minutes.
Calibrate. I'll show you one more in a minute, but if you want entertainment, you should read the editorials in the Wall Street Journal. They are rabidly against global warming, and it's great fun to read. And so I picked a cartoon from the Wall Street Journal to finish with. This is their view of carbon sequestration. That is, we could screw up by making the world a nasty cold place. And I can tell you we have no such ambitions. We're not that greedy. Now, the bottom line of all this is that we've gone in very few years from cartoon science to, by good people who didn't have any assets, to inventing a set of techniques to explore this phenomenon. Every time we've been out there and done something, we've found out something new, and it's a very humbling experience. The equations of state work well, but the rate processes we observe are odd indeed. There's now a wide variety of ways to do this. Put it shallow, put it deep. Put it as a liquid, put it in as a gas. Will it kill the marine life? Will it not? we're at a very early stage of trying to make those evaluations. My point is they should be made by the scientific community on the best ethical basis we can. That's why we're working with our biological colleagues and animals. I can tell you that we're very close to those cages that were sitting on the seafloor died, and animals that were a couple of centimeters up survived, like the ones that could swim. We suspect the reason is the extreme density of CO2 saturated fluids. For the oceanographers here, if you take seawater and saturate it with carbon dioxide, it's like an additional 80 per mil salinity. So it forms a very dense boundary layer, and that just flows along the bottom and then dissipates. And we're about to do a set of dye studies to validate that, and it tells us what scale we have to make our pH measurements over. We're about to do that. It's really, really neat, wonderful, strange science to do. And you ask what the outcome will be. I don't know. If you want to control global warming, then numbers in the millions and billions of tons are going to have to be coped with. I don't think anybody's politically anywhere near coming to this conclusion. But if we don't do the science now, we never will. And remember the slide that showed we've already bought into 30 or 40 years of unrealized global warming. We ought to start now and have some pilot technologies in place. Right now, EPA is not happy with this work. Department of Energy has tried to do a larger scale experiment and they could not get a permit. On the one hand, CO2 is classified as not being a pollutant, therefore not subject to regulation putting in the atmosphere from the Bush administration. But if you want to put it in the ocean, it is. And so obviously there's idiosyncrasies of legislation and emotions and feelings. And everybody's wrestling with this right now. A large international experiment that was planned off Hawaii to be canceled because of public protests, it's probably going to move to Norway. And right now there's a whole bunch of people at work in Norway, Japan, and the US trying to do this kind of science. I think it's kind of neat. So thank you.
Please feel free to ask questions.
Someone comes to the calculation of the energy requirements with carbon emissions.
Yeah, everybody asks, and it's a good question. It's always going to cost money and energy to do work on the product. We've been getting away with it for free. The 75 to 80% of the cost is in the carbon capture. About 15 to 20% is in the disposal. So whether you put it underground or whatever, that's the price you pay. It's a bit cheaper to put it in the ocean than underground because you can get much bigger pipes and because the reservoir is longer. You know, you might fill up an underground reservoir in 10 years and have to move on and you've lost capital. The thing I've skipped over, you know, for seminar time, and because it's chemical engineering outside my field, is the capture step. There is a lot of literature on that. The way in which it's done for getting CO2 for Coca-Cola or something right now, you use a methanolamine scavenger. You just like you scavenge a sulfur dioxide, you'd have a methanolamine or ethanolamine waterfall. That soaks up the CO2. Then you take it through heat exchange and you cook it to get the CO2 back. That robs the power plant of about 30% of its energy. And you'll get a lot of degraded amines, which are an environmental problem to dispose of. And so people are aggressively looking for other ways. There's now a huge literature on this. One is that the way that's being done up in the Alberta project is you enrich the oxygen stream going in. So instead of having 15% CO2 in your waste stream, you boost the oxygen content by, you triple it. You get a much more concentrated CO2 stream in the effluent. It's cheaper to extract it. Another way is to use a catalytic conversion, nickel, copper, oxide to metal conversions, and so on. There's a whole list of these things. The best bet is right now it would cost about 25% more to produce electricity this way. Now, you wouldn't pay more than, that wouldn't be 25% of your electricity bill, because you pay for far more than the cost of generation. You pay for power transmission and taxes and human resources and everything else. So the cost of the household will be less. My guess is that it is going to cost to do this. But if you remember the numbers, in order to do this, I said if you were to put in 1% of the stuff we put in the ocean daily, put it in the deep ocean, you've got a long way towards staving off global warming. If it's not 25% of all electricity produced, it's just the fraction that you choose to do this to. The other nation has an awful lot of money. I remember reading, I think it was Strzok, the cost of bottled water. 99% of the time, the water from your faucet's perfectly good. Yet people spend billions on bottled water. That cost alone would do the job we're talking of here. So people have these fears of, you know, these big costs. It's how you look at it. Now think of it the other way. You know, if we'd started by saying, let's dispose of this stuff carefully, put it on the ground or in the ocean, and then somebody had come along and said, look, we can make this 25% cheaper. Let's just dump it in the air instead. It'll cause global warming, but so what? You want to do that for 25%? Forget it, you know? So it's a mindset, and we've been lured into atmospheric dumping's okay.
How about the technology for a pressurized pipeline to dispose of CO2? How far is that along?
Well, of course, it doesn't have to be that pressurized. You'd only have to pressure for putting it in the ocean. You have to put it in at pressure, but it becomes in the liquid state once it's down around 300 meters. And after that, it's just a fluid you can move. You could theoretically have a paper-thin pipeline. In practice, it's got to bear its own weight and so on. And I've got all the design analyses for that. They use carbon steel pipes right now for the pipeline from North Dakota to Saskatchewan. In fact, there are very large amounts of CO2 moved around the nation. The biggest resource is in the Four Corners area of Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico. There's a big CO2 source there. And they pipe it down to the Gulf of Mexico and sell it for oil field injection. I think it retails for something like $65 a ton there and flows downhill most of the way. So there's a lot of pipeline stuff.
The other sequestration strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I chose not to talk about that today. One is, it's not my research, and we only have an hour. What you refer to here is that our dear colleague, the late John Martin, radicalized the world by pointing out that the ocean was bereft in trace amounts of iron. If you added nanomolar quantities of iron, minute amounts, green plants would thrive. There are many areas of the ocean that are blue, because they have phosphate and nitrate, but no green plants, and it's because they're starved of iron. And nobody believed this, but John was passionate for it, and he was right. And small-scale experiments are done, and then large-scale ones, where a ship will go along and it will spill over the back, trace amounts of iron, fertilize a patch, and it goes bright green. The plants grow, they suck up CO2, the partial pressure of CO2, and the sea surface goes down, and it's wonderful stuff. And John and others said, give me a tank of iron, I'll give you an ice age. You know, we can pull it down. It's not as easy as that. That the science is wonderfully good, but most of the carbon you capture gets back up to the surface in short time. The green plants fall, the plankton, they fall down, they rot. And because of the very aggressive recycling, the efficiency of the ocean, almost all of that CO2 comes back within the same year. Moreover, you can't do it once. You know, you've got a Faustian body. You do it one year, you do it the next year, you do it the next year. And you would have to fertilize vast areas of the ocean annually. So this would be perturbation of ecosystems on an unprecedented scale. You would have to fertilize areas the size of land continents to try and achieve some of these numbers and do it every year. And this would imply an army of ships dispersing huge amounts of iron. And the ethical and ecological issues there are, in fact, I think, worse than putting a small amount down a pipeline, which is really not going to be much worse than a sewage system or whatever. But people ask me, you know, do I think this is a good thing? Is one critical question. It's a terrible thing. You know, we got ourselves into this state where we have to consider these billion-dollar, million-ton pipelines and so on. It's awful. Nobody likes it. But you got to be honest and look at the numbers, and frankly, that's what they come to, so we might as well talk about it. Yeah.
Further questions? Comments? Yes, questions?
What do you think is the consequence of just covering the bottom of the ocean with all this goop?
No, it dissolves pretty quickly. Yeah, I mean, we got the dissolution rate.
But doesn't
Well, if you put it down deep, it spills, it would roll downhill. Because of the circulation of the ocean, there's a general correlation between ocean retention time and depth. If you put it in, let's say, 2,500 meters depth, it would slowly float upwards and would dissolve in the water column, and you wouldn't get it sitting on the seafloor. It then becomes dissolved in the ocean, and there are now some elegant models of this, nice geophysical fluid dynamic models. They move in Norway, do them very well. And that lowers the pH of seawater in the region adjacent to the outlet, and you would maybe have 10 cubic kilometers of seawater that would be at the stage where there would be physiological stress. Look at the Los Angeles Hyperion sewage outfall, it's similar things. Those are choices we're going to have to make. I don't know which is better, melt the ice caps, kill off the polar bears, or the other. Remember I said that we're already giving a third of the target to nuclear and solar. We're going to give a third of it to efficiency. They can't accumulate the amounts that we've got here. And frankly, this is the only technology which has this capacity and also preserves the multi-trillion dollar infrastructure in the energy system which we all own today. So it's a rather ugly industrial equation, and but you've got to find out the truth. I think if you look at the pH of the ocean, a great many marine animals migrate each day through pH gradients of about 0.3. They go from the oxygen minimum up to the surface. Of course, a lot of them don't, the ones that just live at that depth anyway. And there's pH gradients from east to west of ocean basins, and then North Atlantic to South Atlantic, and so on. So there are pH gradients established which animals have adapted to. Now you can argue, of course, that for that animal at that place, it's adapted to that value, and you want to preserve and cherish that niche. And so you would strive to do that. The truth is that the oceans have changed with time. We're already changing the ocean from the invasion I showed you. The surface pH of seawater has changed by more than 0.1 pH unit already. And it's going to change by 0.3 to 0.4 units as we march on through this century. So you're already changing the carbon chemistry of the ocean a lot. And you're putting it in the surface water, and that's where the coral reefs are. And, you know, we're in a mess.